And can you tell our listeners about a little bit about Weston Price and what they're all about?
So Weston,
because you're a Weston Price chapter leader in the Valley, correct?
I am. Uh-huh. Yes. So Weston Price was a dentist who traveled the world in the 30s and visited a number of traditional cultures. And he was trying to answer the question, why do all these people have beautiful teeth when back in Cleveland I'm seeing all kinds of people with dental challenges? What is the difference? And what he found is that these people were eating their traditional foods. And so then he kind of made the next step and inquired, okay, well, what are the common traditional foods in all of these cultures? And in finding that, he also was able to see that it translated not only into perfect piano key teeth, but it translated into perfect, impeccable health and beautiful people. So then from there, there's a foundation now that kind of promotes those traditional foods.
Mm-hmm. And Sally Fallon is co-wrote Nourishing Traditions along with Mary Enig, correct? And they're the ones that founded the Weston Price
Yes.
Foundation?
Exactly.
And I'm wondering if you could say maybe a little bit of the difference between the traditional diet and, say, what is maybe a traditional American diet.
Okay. Well, so traditional diet, first of all, uses all of the animal. So kind of the animal parts that we don't like to see that, you know, quote, disgust us in American culture, like organ meats and the bones. Mm-hmm. Those are the things that traditional cultures actually specifically harvest and enjoy because they are so nutrient dense. So that's one thing. Traditional cultures all have in common some form of fermented foods as well, and that is something that we don't see very often in American culture either. All of our food is processed or overcooked, or and we'd like to stay away from sort of the raw fermented foods. And so those are two major differences there.
Seems like there might be some, you know, apprehension about eating organ meat. Like, is it safe?
I've heard people refer to it as the nasty bits. So yeah. So wait. So could you talk a little bit about that in terms of, you know, how would one go about starting to think about eating organ meats like spleen or liver or kidneys?
Right. Right.
And it's, you know, and I'm sure there's probably other aspects of a traditional diet that mm-hmm. maybe go beyond just the organ meats, but mm-hmm. you know,
mm-hmm. and even making bone broths. How do you go about cooking bone?
Right.
Down to make a broth. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So let's see. Well, organ meats, the first thing you need to think about is where did they come from? So, you know, when you go into the grocery store and you buy liver, you're just not sure where that cow, what that cow has been eating. And that's really, really important when you're picking out organ meats. So buying organ meats from a local source where you know the farmer, you know what that animal has been eating, or harvesting your own organ meats. For instance, I don't know if many people know, but when you go dip netting in the Copper River, there's a lot of food that gets tossed back in the river, including the livers, for instance, of the, you know, red salmon, and those are absolutely delicious.
Mm-hmm.
So for meats that you can't quite identify where the source is, I would recommend freezing the meats first for a couple weeks and just be sure that the pathogens are out. And then people really like pate to start with, adding onions and herbs and blending up, say, liver. That can be more palatable to a lot of people, kind of a good introduction.
What are the benefits when you eat organ meats? What do most people notice? Why would you do it?
So organ meats, like specifically liver, is sort of like the powerhouse of the body. So it's, you know, when we assimilate nutrients and minerals from the foods, it goes throughout our body into our cells, and then what's left over gets stored in the liver. And so the liver just stores lots of nutrient-dense products and lots of vitamins A and B and folate and iron and just a plethora of ingredients that are good for us.
I've heard a lot of people say, I don't want to eat liver because that's the organ that does all the detoxification, so isn't it toxic, so wouldn't I want to avoid it?
Right. So it just depends mm-hmm. on that source
right.
again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, right. And then you were talking about the bone broths.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So bone broths, like let's take salmon again. A lot of people just, you know, they fillet their salmon and then they throw them back in the river. Well, if you took that filleted carcass and you cooked the backbone and the head with that and turned it into a stock, and then you could filter it out and can it. And then what we do is, for instance, we'll put like half a jar of that stock in our brown rice or whatever. You cook it right into the rice and you can hardly even taste a fishy flavor. Mm-hmm. And that is just power packed with, again, a lot of minerals. And that is one of the few food sources of just basically patching up the digestive system when people have, say, for instance, leaky gut syndrome or digestive problems. That is just...
Which we see a lot of people who have that issue in our practice, you know, who are, their digestive system is so compromised that stuff is basically leaking out into their bloodstream and causing issues. So doing bone broths, nourishing bone broths is a way to actually heal
the
gut.
Now, was that specifically the salmon bones, or, you know, are we speaking about bones in general?
All kinds of bones. Okay. All kinds of bones, yeah. Meat bones and chicken bones and...
Now, would it be okay to freeze the broth as well as, you know, canning or jarring? Is there
sure.
one method that's better than the other that would preserve the nutrients?
I think freezing would be fantastic. Yeah, we just don't have a big enough freezer, so I do a lot of canning.
Well, I know when I'm going to the restaurant, a Vietnamese restaurant, the pho is really delicious, and usually they'll have, you know, a bone broth base, and that's always just really great on a, you know, like when it's really, really cold
mm-hmm.
out.
Yeah, it just feels really nourishing and
yeah,
warm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what would be the first thing somebody who's coming to this conversation and just knows nothing about traditional foods, what would you recommend somebody do just to start? What would be the first thing that you would say?
Well, I would probably go back to fermented foods mm-hmm. and maybe talk about some really easy recipes to try to introduce them mm-hmm. to fermented foods, like, for instance, sauerkraut, which is essentially cabbage and salt. And you just shred the cabbage and you pound it with your hand and you let it sit out for a couple days, and then you put it in your refrigerator or root cellar, and in a week or a couple weeks you have sauerkraut. And that has so many beneficial bacteria, and it also eliminates toxins from the body. It helps us digest better because it's a little bit acidic, and so it adds a little bit of acid to the stomach when you're digesting food. So, you know, that's a really quick and easy way to sort of introduce some of these traditional foods and get used to the taste too.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't even need a specialized crock pot then to do it, really. I've seen people just put it in jars.
You can do it in jars, mm-hmm. you can do it in buckets, mm-hmm. whatever you want.
Whatever you want to put it in.
Yeah.
Now, are there places in the valley to learn how to do fermented food preparations? Are you aware of some resources that they could help people learn how to do that on their own?
Well, I know of one woman who has taught a couple classes at the Kellogg Farm, Allie Barker, and she has a great fermented foods class that she usually offers in the summertime, though I hope that over at our clinic we can get her or someone else to do a fermented foods workshop also this spring.
Great.
Yeah, Allie's fantastic.
Yeah, we hope to have her on our show too.
We'll definitely have her on the show, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's wonderful.
And then you can also, that book, Nourishing Traditions, kind of explains things really well and gives a good fermentation recipe, as well as a fantastic book by Sandor Katz called Wild Fermentation, and he basically takes like any food possible and ferments it.
Mm-hmm.
He's crazy about fermenting, so
yeah. And that
makes
book,
it fun.
Nourishing Traditions, I tell people the first 60 pages of that book is just such an amazing introduction to diet.
Mm-hmm.
It just completely flips everything that people get told in the media on its ear. You know,
up is down
yeah.
and down is up. Everything
yeah.
that you kind of learn growing up is turned on its head in the first 60 pages
yeah.
of that book.
But exactly. if people just digest that, it's really amazing. I think it will mm-hmm. change how people think about food and what their approach is to eating. And then the whole book is just chock full. The sidebars are wonderful.
Yes.
Every single one is great. I mean, you can go through that book and skip the recipes the first time and just read the sidebars about the research that's been done on traditional foods. It's
right.
pretty amazing.
Right. It is fantastic. I agree.
So maybe we could talk a little bit about how does a family begin to transition towards this way of eating. And, you know, oftentimes people are very short with time and, you know, it's convenience, it's cost savings. There's a lot of things that are directing people's food choices that aren't necessarily about nourishment. It's just, you know, feed the family, keep the fuel coming. Mm-hmm. You know, if it tastes good, if it's inexpensive and it has a long shelf life, you know, that's actually gauging a lot of people's food choices. So when people are really busy, how do they begin to transition to a really nourishing diet? And also there's a lot of time involved probably in the food prep that would have to be accommodated in people's schedules. Any suggestions or thoughts about that?
It's true. I think that planning is just enormous and anticipating. Like, for instance, here in Alaska in the spring and summer and fall is when we do lots of harvesting, and just trying really hard to plan ahead and make it a priority, because you're right, it's time consuming. But when you think about, you know, all the things that you want to do to keep your children healthy and keep yourselves healthy, one of the most fundamental is what you put in your mouth. And there are some amazing resources up here. So if families start planning ahead, like, okay, well, let's make a long weekend in July and go down to the Kenai and harvest our fish. And let's have another long weekend in the fall in September and harvest gallons of blueberries, because Alaska blueberries are higher in antioxidants and nutrients than any other blueberry studied. And wow. And and actually, you can also ferment blueberries, which is a really, really tasty treat as
I
well.
I tasted some of the fermented blueberries when I went to one of Aubrey's classes, and they're really good. Yeah.
So
I was trying that one.
It definitely involves a larger lifestyle change, and people just have to put it in perspective and recognize that there are probably some places where they can let go of, you know, taking their kids to, you know, an after-school activity every day. Well, instead of maybe every day, let's spend a couple days a week in the kitchen with mom preparing some really high-quality good foods for the family. And it's really empowering not only for mom but for the kids too, and it keeps them connected to what's real.
And you guys actually did you get a whole cow or did you get – half a cow? What did you do?
We got like a third of a cow.
A third of a cow, okay.
Probably.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And how long did it take to process that? And what? I think you talked about making scrapple, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah. We used everything. Uh-huh. Yes. So for those of you who don't know what scrapple is, well, how we made it is we actually cut the hooves off and took the nails off of the cow and actually skinned the head and put it all in a pot together with water and cooked it for like 16 hours, and then you drain it and you have the meat and you pick out the meat that you're like, that looks pretty good. I don't know about this. I'm not so sure. And then you put it through a grinder and you add some herbs and cornmeal and put it in a bread pan and let it set up. And then we cut them in half and freeze them. And then when we want to eat them, we take them out and we cut them up in slices and put them on the griddle and then throw on and fry them up in butter and throw a bunch of yogurt and blueberries and bananas and nuts and a little bit of maple syrup, and it is delicious.
Wow.
And you don't really need to eat anything else that day.
It doesn't sound like it for the whole week.
Yeah, when I eat that before work, I usually have to peel off some layers and fan myself.
That's awesome.
So, yes, you can use the whole cow, and that's what's so great about processing your own meat and learning how to do it is that, you know, instead of having Matt Valley Meats do it for you or buying it at the store, you have access to all these other materials that are just so important. So.
And what was your source for the cow this year? Where did you get the cow from? Or did you guys
raise? That was from a farmer named Tracy Moffitt, and I believe that he has more cows for sale if anybody's interested. He's selling them for $1 to $2 a pound, essentially, which
wow.
is a great deal.
Mm-hmm. So you process it yourself.
The initial deed, mm-hmm. and then you have to do the rest. And
right.
yes, you could always mm-hmm. take it to Matt Valley Meats if you want to.
Mm-hmm.
So, and on that note, just another thing, if you're not interested in eating organ meats by themselves, another great thing to do with them is when you buy a cow from Tracy Moffitt and you get those organ meats and you bring them over to Matt Valley Meats, and when they process the hamburger meat, they can grind that organ meat in there, and you hardly even taste it, but every time you have hamburger, mm-hmm. you're eating some of the organ meat.
Yeah, you're getting all that extra nutrition. That's a great idea. Good for picky eaters.
Right.
Uh-huh. Awesome.
Disguise it.
Uh-huh.
So when people think about traditional diet, and the word diet is in there. People are thinking dieting or some, you know, some bad diet. And so how do you draw a distinction? This is a lifestyle. This is clearly, this is actually just a totally different orientation around eating. And people have heard about a whole foods diet, and then
Paleo diet is another one that comes up. So
how do you draw the distinctions between these? And then I also wanted to ask for the vegetarians out there who actually really want to move in a direction of more wholesome eating. You know, in the traditional cultures, indigenous cultures, were there ever, you know, evidence of vegetarian indigenous populations that did, you know, very well and had robust health and vital bone structure and good teeth?
Right. Well, I might be a little bit biased on this subject, so you guys might be better resources than I am.
We like bias. Go for it.
From what Weston Price discovered, there really weren't very many vegetarian cultures at all. At least some of the, you know, cultures may not have been eating beef or wild game, but at least they were, they could have been drinking raw milk, or they could have been harvesting the eggs from various fowl. So there aren't, if you are a vegetarian, there are tricks to keeping yourself relatively healthy, though there are some very essential nutrients that are going to be really hard for you to get, like B12 and iron in really high sources. And so, I don't know if you guys have anything more to add to that in particular.
I think, you know, doing your best to eat fermented foods and you know, adding in, you know, if the person at least is willing to eat some dairy, you know, raw dairy and eggs, you know, even if they don't want to eat fish or chicken or beef, I think they're going to do better. Miso is a good one, you know, but
right,
again, it's
that's
just
fermented.
Yeah, it's fermented.
You know,
nutritional
yeast is a source of that, of B12. I think that might be another option.
Some people say seaweed. I've heard both things. You know, if you talk to Maine Coast sea vegetables, they say it's the B12 analog is actually usable, but I hear other people saying no, that you really have to take the B supplement.
Right.
So, yeah.
So you have to be really careful. But at the same time, that can be a very cleansing, quote, diet, a vegetarian or vegan diet for somebody who's trying to transition, you know, going into from a standard American diet to kind of a vegetarian vegan, to kind of help cleanse the body a little bit, and then introducing, you know, some of the meats and, you know, high quality meat is sometimes really good for people.
That's a really good point, because there are certain the distinction is made between two different types of cancers: the solid cancers, like bowel cancer or breast cancer, or you know, anything that's got a tumor, versus more of the blood cancers. And what alternative cancer researchers have found is that the solid cancers do much better on a strict vegetarian diet without any animal products in it. But in fact, the blood cancer people do better on a diet that has more meat and has more dairy in it. So that even that distinction is interesting. I've heard people say with cancer, you don't want to you want to go all vegetables, but it even depends on the type of cancer. So I think when you're talking about, are we trying to nourish the person, then, you know, a whole foods diet incorporating animal foods is really useful. But like you said, when you're trying to do a cleanse or make a transition, then temporarily switching over to a vegetarian based diet is good.
Right.
And back to your question about the distinction between, you know, what's a whole food diet, what's a paleo diet, what's a traditional diet,
there's sort of ambiguous lines there. But I would say that a whole foods diet oftentimes will emphasize grains in it. And there isn't a whole lot of space for grains in some of the other diets. Grains in traditional diets are often fermented once again. So fermented grains is more of the traditional route. And then the Paleolithic diet is sort of seen as the diet that we as humans have eaten for most of our species existence. And essentially it's meats, vegetables, nuts, seeds, berries. That's essentially a Paleolithic diet, and a lot of people do very well on that. And there's a lot of crossover with a traditional diet and a paleo diet. There's a lot of crossover there. So I would say the Weston Price diet implements more raw dairy and more fermented grains than a paleo diet would.
And if people want to learn more about Weston Price, you can go to westonaprice.org, and they have tons of information up there. I mean, again, you can get probably five PhDs in nutrition just going to that website. It's mm-hmm. wonderful.
And it's interesting because there's an ongoing debate between the China study folks who really advocate for a, you know, for a vegetarian diet and have a lot of science and research to advocate for that position. And I think the Weston Price Foundation has a pretty good response to that.
Yeah, and I actually have, for anybody who's interested, you're welcome to email me. I have some information that takes a look at the research on the China study. The China study supposedly proved that a vegetarian diet was healthier based on looking at a Chinese population, and I've got several people who've taken that data and actually looked at what the conclusions were and decided that the data was not exactly crunched the way it should be, and so came out with misleading results.
Right.
So, yeah, I'd say it's still open for debate, but Weston Price people have to say about it, I tend to put a little bit more stock in, pun intended.
And there's some interesting debates between the author of the China study and some of these paleo researchers and Weston Price people, and it's definitely enlightening if you listen to those.
You know, and on the theme of wholesome meats, I was talking to Francois Vecchio, who's a very experienced sausage maker and really with the old European style of producing wholesome sausage and meat preparation.
In fact, we should give him a plug because I believe it's February 4th on Saturday. He's going to be doing...
Is it the Palmer
Depot?
Yes,
at the Palmer Depot. He's going to be doing a bunch of traditionally produced sausages and meats. They're going to be available there.
Yeah, and he's traveled around the world and he does... consulting work. He's a master in this, and he really has the old world style and skills that are very rare to find at this point. And what he said about Alaska is that we are so, so lucky because the industrial farming practices that are so prevalent in the lower 48 states has not penetrated this market. So you're really getting incredibly clean, well cared for animals that really aren't suffering, and that the quality of the meat is very, very good.
And then he's using natural preservation methods, so he's not using a lot of the additives that we're accustomed to. And even if he's using some additives, he's using them in a way in which by the time the final product is produced, it doesn't have the level of additives that we're used to seeing in our packaged meats in the supermarket.
Right, and the beauty of that is that he's called the poet of pork. and if with these pure meats and the pure pigs and what they're eating up here, you can eat a lot of pork. I mean, when was the last time you went to your doctor and they said, okay, you need to up the sausage, you need to up the lard, you need to have more pork in your diet. That's the beauty of this diet, is that when you're getting really good food, high-quality foods like that, then
you know
you can
what the
eat
animal's
it.
Eating.
Yes.
And that actually, Weston Price just did a whole study on pork, because some cultures say that pork is a, quote, unclean meat. I happen to be from a Jewish background, and Judaism, they say that pork is supposedly unclean. But then in Thailand, they actually say chicken is the unclean meat, and they eat a lot of pork. So there's a debate back and forth. But what Weston Price did is they prepared pork according to traditional methods where they cured it, or they marinated it. Yeah. There was some sort of additional preparation in addition to the cooking. And what they did was they fed this pork to people after taking a look at a live blood sample before and after. And the only pork that caused changes in the blood was the pork that had only been cooked but hadn't been marinated or salted or cured.
Right.
So I found that really interesting, that maybe that bias against eating pork came from people noticing that if you don't actually prepare the pork properly, then it may have some temporary changes or it may cause some illness. You know, not to mention, you know, you can get pork that has parasites in it, of course. I mean, that's an issue too. But maybe that recognition was understanding that you have to prepare it in a certain way.
Yes.
And somehow that kind of translated into pork is not good for you.
Exactly. Yeah. And traditional peoples have that knowledge. So looking back at that knowledge and is very important for us to stay healthy in what we're eating.
Yeah, it's really interesting just to go back and look at the history of how foods were prepared. Even 100 years ago, things were so different than they are now.
Mm-hmm. You know, I read this story about, I think it was an Arctic explorer named Sven.
We'll call him Sven.
Yeah, he, He was well documented meat eater, and we're going to come back in just a few minutes here. And
we're going to take a station break in about 2 seconds,
and
we'll be right back.
Thanks for joining us.
How much time do we have?
Five on your FM dial, Big Cabbage Radio.
Welcome back to the Bridge to Everywhere. And tonight we're interviewing Aubrey Spangler, nurse practitioner on traditional foods. And I just want to say I love being on Big Cabbage Radio. I smile every time I hear that.
It's fun just to say
Big Cabbage Radio. So, go ahead.
I'd like to see the addition of Big Fermented Cabbage.
Big Fermented, I love it. Okay, well, tonight it's Big Fermented Cabbage Radio.
So this is the Bridge to Everywhere, and tonight our guest is Aubrey Spangler. She's a nurse practitioner at Matthew Midwifery, and she's an expert on traditional diets and healing with whole foods and a whole food diet and helping families get lined up with a new way of eating to keep their families healthy and strong.
So we were talking about Sven the Explorer when we took our break.
Yeah, I read recently a story about this Arctic explorer named Sven, and he modeled his eating from some of the traditional methods from the indigenous populations in the places that he visited. And he was known to just eat meat and nothing else. And so there was a big idea at the time that you'd get scurvy and that, you know, a person couldn't stay healthy if there weren't other things in the diet. And so there was a study done where they hold him up in a hotel room in New York City, and I think this is in the early 1900s, maybe in the 1920s or something like that, for a full year. And they, you know, were watching to make sure he didn't have anything else but meat or bones. And
they gave him a hotel room to do his
everything.
taking apart the meat.
But he had the traditional methods of preparing the meats and the bones and that he had learned from indigenous populations. And then they did blood draws and watched his blood chemistry. And sure enough, a year later, he was doing absolutely fine, tip-top shape. Blood chemistry came out great.
Now, the adrenal glands are a source of vitamin C, aren't they? Is that correct?
I can't remember.
In the way that it was cooked and the, you know, the gelatin and the bone and mm-hmm. the marrow. And so there was just some aspect of in the fermentation process that mm-hmm. the nutrients that...
Right. Well, if you're getting that combination, then you're getting practically everything you need. And you can also see it in terms of what you're eating will help your body in a practical way. Like, for instance, I know a lot of people don't really like to eat fish eyes. But if you cook the fish broth up with the heads, then you're going to get some of the nutrients in those fish eyes, which is a lot of it is vitamin A, and it apparently will make your vision better. And, you know, eating the bone stocks will make your bones stronger and your joints feel better. And so it's all kind of practical back
and
to the body.
The Chinese have a recipe for fish head stew, which is particularly for the thyroid. And we have so many people in our culture right now, I'm sure you see a lot of people with thyroid issues.
Yeah.
So, yeah, eat some fish head stew and seaweed.
when I was growing up in Anchorage, we had neighbors that were really eating the traditional way. So my best friend, Doug Heron, his mom, Sally, was a native Alaskan. And, you know, she really, you know, she would come over when we went out fishing, she would ask for the fish heads. And, you know, are you gonna use those fish heads? And we're like, well, no. You know, and so, you know, we were just like, wow, you know. And I went over there and had dinner one night. It wasn't actually that bad, you know. And
no.
But it was just so foreign. It was just so outside
exactly.
of our Indian experience.
Right. So we have to remember that when we first eat this stuff, it's going to be an acquired taste for a lot of us. But over time, when we start realizing the health benefits too and how they make us feel, it just, you know, you can eat it, but, you know.
Have you made your own caviar from
yes,
fish eggs?
Yes, that was another thing I wanted to make sure that people knew about, was that those fish eggs are, traditionally speaking, they are a sacred food for fertility. And so instead of throwing them back in the river, that is one of the first things that we process when we get home from the river is the fish eggs. And you can get sort of like this hardware mesh, and you can put the fish eggs through there to kind of split them from that visceral layer.
Mm-hmm.
And then you salt them for a little while, and then you can put them in jars. And, you know, we'll eat those with, you know, say some cream cheese and crackers, or, you know, or actually what we also like to do with them is we'll put them in our salads, a couple tablespoons of fish eggs in a big fresh green salad with some feta in there, and it just tastes a little bit salty, but you can't really, it doesn't taste fishy, and it is just nutrient dense, just packed.
I actually had some fish eggs from a friend a few years ago, and I made it myself, and I was so proud of myself that I made my own caviar. It's actually really good.
Good.
You know, I think about how expensive it is to buy caviar. It's a bit of work to get the fish eggs out of the mesh, but
right.
It does taste really good, and it preserves really well.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the only thing from the fish that I don't particularly like are the male gonads, and maybe I'm just being a little biased, but my husband even made me try that, but I refused to do it. But he put it in a stir fry. He snuck it in one night. And I took a big fat bite. I was so hungry. And all of a sudden it was just, I knew what it was. And I was pretty disappointed, but at least I tasted it.
Uh-huh. That sort of seems like his payback for, did you ever sneak tofu and food for him back
right,
when?
Exactly.
Yeah. I know a lot of people who like try to sneak tofu and things for people. She's
right.
The wife trying to sneak the tofu in for the husband, so he got you back with the fish.
Really on,
I'm
you know,
sure I did. I made a French silk pie when I thought tofu was healthy, and I snuck it in there, and you never knew.
Right.
But on that note, just recognize that the male gonads are actually really good for male fertility. So
they have a lot of zinc in them.
So go ahead, hubbies and boyfriends out there. Dig in.
You know, as we're talking about this, I'm just thinking, like, how lucky are we to live in this area? I mean,
we are
between
so lucky.
Just the natural resources and the abundance of really wholesome foods and wild game, berries and herbs.
Right, right. And another good source of wild foods around here that anybody can go and access that's really family-oriented is to go down to Turnagain Arm, the 20-mile river in April, and get your buckets of hooligan. So those hooligans just come in. You have to bring these little nets out, and kids are down there. You know, people from all sorts of cultures are down there, and just putting their nets in the water. And those hooligans have, you know, for the natives, they call them candlefish. They have a lot of really good oils in them. And so that's another thing. You can actually eat them whole. You can cook them and eat them whole, besides the bones, and you won't even really be able to tell.
I went with a friend who was into getting hooligan, and we got, you know, a couple of 5-gallon buckets worth of hooligan. It was a lot of work to process them because we smoked them. She had a smoker, and we cured them with the salt and sugar cure, and then smoked them, and then we did a freezer pack with them and put them in the freezer. And I thought they were actually really great trail snacks because they were just full of fat and just full of energy. So when you're climbing a mountain, the only thing that I worry about a little bit hiking in Alaska is that you smell
like
greasy fish.
Yeah,
bears like the smell of the hooligan too. So, you know, I was eating the hooligan as a snack, and I probably smelled like a bear snack.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, but otherwise it's great. I mean, a lot of people hike with peanut butter for the same reason, and I'm sure, you know, peanut butter is pretty smelly. So I don't know that I would take them into the backcountry where there were lots of bears, but it really was a good, and it, you know, we started out with them frozen, and by the time, you know, you were midway through the hike, they were perfect for just eating, and you could eat them whole.
Exactly.
Just chew on them.
Exactly. Yep.
You know, there's something else I wanted to talk about, which is when we're talking about all of this natural abundance and these resources here, we're also talking about sustainability. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that, because less dependence on processed food, less dependence on imported foods, and more dependence on what's here already, and learning how to work with the food that's here, and we're better nourished, and we're more sustainable as a community. What do you think about that?
Well, that's the beauty of it, is that there are so many benefits to it. And, you know, you go to the local grocery store, and the vast majority of those foods have traveled 5,000 miles to get there. And is that really sustainable? That they're all coming up, you know, via ship or plane? It's not. And so, you know, they say that, you know, Anchorage has a 4-day supply of food. So if anything happened to the ports or whatever, that, you know, that's all we'd have. And so it's really important to keep that in perspective. And these foods are not only so nourishing, but they're also sustainable. They're grown here on the land. This is where they've been. And we're so lucky, because there are very few other places on the whole planet that has access to the foods that we have access to here. So it's sustainable, and it's so nourishing, and empowering for everybody, and not only adults, but you can really bring your families into it, your kids as well, and empower them as well, and make them more connected to the local food movement, which is very important.
Right, and you can see maybe artisan foods, and maybe that becomes really a potential economic opportunity as well.
Exactly.
It just grows in this area.
Yes.
So I want to talk a little bit about, you've got two presentations coming up. One is going to be January 26th, that's Thursday night,
mm-hmm.
from 6:30 to 8:30, and that's going to be Nourishing Our Families. And you're going to discuss four pillars of good nutrition: first foods for baby, feeding your family on a budget, how to take advantage of local Alaska foods, practical changes to help shift your family towards healthier eating. She's also going to go into picky eaters and foods to avoid and why. That's going to be at Matsu Midwifery, and it's going to be $15 per person, $15 per couple, or $10 per person. If you want to sign up for that, you can call Matsu Midwifery 373-3420. And then you also have on Thursday, February 29th, also from 6:30 to 8:30 at Matsu Midwifery. Oh, sorry, 6:30?
I think it's February 6th. It's
February 9th?
February 9th.
Okay, yep. Thursday, yep. February 9th, 6:30 to 8:30. Also at Matsu Midwifery, and it's going to be $5 for Matsu Midwifery clients and $10 for non-Matsu Midwifery clients. That number again is 373-3420 if you want to sign up. This one's called Sacred Nutrition for Preconception, Fertility, and Beyond. And in this workshop, she's going to talk about how to have beautiful, healthy babies, why preconception and prenatal nutrition matters, advantages to mother and baby of proper nutrition, sacred foods for fertility, conception, and pregnancy, traditional diets versus modern diets and degenerative diseases, food sources of specific vitamins and minerals, and easy tools to help implement the diet. So since you're pregnant right now, it might be good to discuss a little bit about why this diet benefits women and men who are trying to get pregnant, and also how it results in having a healthier baby.
Okay. Well, all I can say is that in my first, like personally speaking, in my first pregnancy, I wasn't aware of all of this information. And it wasn't an extremely difficult pregnancy, but I had a lot of pregnancy symptoms. I had heartburn. I had really bad constipation. I had backaches. I had pelvic pain. I had difficulty sleeping and just general discomfort. And it took me quite a while to rebound after having my child. And this pregnancy has just been flawless practically. It has just been so easy. And I really believe that it's because of the foods that I'm eating. So, you know, I am nourishing my baby with all kinds of incredible local, you know, foods and fermented foods. And so I feel strong and my baby feels strong, and I just think that that it's a really important time for women and families to kind of reflect on their health when they're pregnant and try their best, because this is, you know, this can set the stage for the rest of your child's life is right now in pregnancy. And we need to take it really seriously. You know, so many of us are just busy with our lives, and we try to crank everything out, you know, as much as we can before the baby gets here, and we don't kind of take a step back and say, okay, I really, really need to take care of myself and my
right.
baby here. And
so the question
starts in the womb.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What color to paint the baby's room is less important than what am I going to feed the baby for,
yes.
for the 9 months. But also it's really important to think about if you're thinking about getting pregnant or you've had trouble getting pregnant, you know, what are you feeding yourself? You know, what's the woman eating? What's the man eating? And I know in traditional cultures that's actually considered that's what the couple does. You know, they're looking
yes.
at getting nourished before they actually even get to the part where they're conceiving the baby.
Right.
So we don't even think about that so much in our culture.
We don't. Right. So natives have often they have the bare fat diet where they'll put the moms and the dads on just eating bare meat and bare fats. And
wow.
then there's in China, pregnant women try to eat as many eggs as possible. And these are, you know, pastured eggs with chickens that are eating grass and bugs and outside taking in the vitamin D. And many, many cultures will use the fish eggs as, you know, sacred fertile food. So, I mean, people have thought about this for a long time. They've had, quote, designer babies based on what they eat, and they have beautiful, healthy, intelligent children. And we are all entitled to that. That is our birthright, to be all be beautiful and healthy and intelligent. And that a lot of that comes from what we eat.
And you've read that book, Deep Nutrition by Catherine Shanahan,
yes.
is that the name?
Yeah.
She talks about that in the book, about how when you look at somebody who we traditionally would say, oh, that person's beautiful, you know, they have great bone structure, it's just the way they move, the way, you know, the way they sound, there's something beautiful about them, that there is a lot of evidence that is directly related to its genetic wealth. It has to do with diet.
Yes.
So how you eat before you get pregnant and how you eat when you're pregnant makes a huge difference in that realm.
It's interesting
yeah.
because we've all heard you are what you eat, mm-hmm. but it somehow has lost its real ability to affect us. You know, we might say it, but, you know, to really think about what we're eating having this causative effect that ripples out not just in our own physiology but in our family. And
we even have a rock in our office that
do,
says you are
do.
What you eat right in front of the tea.
I know that.
You know, but
yeah.
I think it's a product of scientific reductionism mm-hmm. where you might, if okay, I need to get 6 grams of protein. Well, I'm going to go ahead and get this powdered, this pea powder.
Pea protein or hemp protein.
And,
yeah.
you know, and somehow that would be as nutritional as 6 grams of protein in a fresh fillet of salmon. And I don't think that's common sense. If you stop and think about that, I'd say that's ridiculous. There's something else going on between these two things. They're not the
yeah.
same.
We had a friend who would say when he would eat an energy bar, he would sit for a moment and say, tastes like technology.
So to get out of that mindset that, you know, food is fuel and, you know, if it's, you know, gets me by Taco Bell,
protein
you know, whatever
is protein
it
might
be,
is protein,
like a quick
yeah.
thing. But to really think about, you know, certainly if you're trying to get pregnant, you want to create an internal environment that is really rich and vital, that's going to welcome and support life happening mm-hmm. there and happening, you know, blossoming beautifully. And so that has to be deliberately created through choices.
Yeah.
And not to mention, I think there's a bit of a misconception out there. A lot of people say, well, I have these health problems and it's due to my genetics. It's my parents' fault. This is just what I was born with.
Parents
and
had diabetes.
Yeah. So,
exactly.
Well, I guess this is just what I'm stuck with. This is what I'm going to end up with. And I know even Dr. Oz says that for the first, you know, until you become maybe a teenager or so, maybe 2/3 of who you are is determined by genetics, and it's 1/3 what you eat. But beyond that, once you get into adulthood, it flips. It's more like 2/3 you know, what you do, diet and lifestyle, and it's about 1/3 genetics. And I think there's more and more evidence that it's even less so.
Yes.
There's a whole science of epigenetics coming
yes.
out right now that's really showing that certain genes get turned on or get turned off in the presence of what we do, what we eat, how much sleep are we getting. you know, how much exercise are we getting, whether we're getting enough nutrition. And so all of that plays a role in whether or not our genes express themselves. So to me, that's completely liberating.
It exactly.
It really shows me that we have so much more control over. There are a lot of things we don't have control over, like we don't have control over who our parents were, but we certainly have control over what we put in our bodies once we're old enough to know better.
Right, and there may be a genetic predisposition towards or tendency towards certain kinds of chronic illnesses. But, you know, when a patient, you know, comes to us and they're saying, well, you know, my parents had, you know, high blood pressure or, you know, this runs in the family, you know, we like to ask and say, well, do you have the same lifestyle as they had? You know, were they avid exercisers? Did they eat whole foods, wholesome foods? You know, did they live well and take good care of them? Oh, no, they didn't take care of themselves very much at all. And I'm like, well, okay, are you living in the same way that they lived?
Exactly.
You know, so are you exercising? Are you eating really well? Are you getting good sleep? You know, all the basics, are those covered? Well, probably not. And I say, great, well, then there's so much opportunity for change here. There's so much potential. That's wonderful. So let's get these things, you know, in place, and then let's see where we are. You know, and so that just opens it right up. Now, there's a rare, very rare person, very, very rare, where a person does have high blood pressure and it's really high. They're very young and they're avid exercisers. They're doing all the right things. So that does happen, but it is actually quite rare.
Very true. Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the things that, you know, just since we're talking about diseases, you know, common degenerative or chronic diseases that people have. What are some of the things that you've seen turn around or change when people adopt a traditional diet?
Well, so I see a lot of newborns and children at my clinic, and so many of them have eczema and digestive problems, lots of constipation, lots of inability to sleep, lots of unidentified allergies, and essentially it goes back to the fact that they have their immune systems are not intact. And most of our immune systems lie in our digestive system. 75% to 80% of our immune system is in our digestive system. So essentially what we're eating is contributing to all of these problems. So if we introduce things like probiotic foods and the bone broths and identify some of the food allergies, all of these, so many of these conditions can just be improved just with that alone. So that's one thing I see a lot of.
Mm-hmm. We see just taking people off of the standard American diet and getting them on what we call an anti-inflammatory diet, which doesn't, we don't actually start people at the traditional diet level like what you're talking about, but just getting all of the inflammatory foods,
processed foods
mm-hmm. and things like alcohol,
sugar,
and caffeine, sugar. A lot of people have wheat sensitivities. Just with that, we see things start to turn around, and almost everybody who's had trouble loses weight. They say they're sleeping better. A lot of people say that they're just happier.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's always surprising
to me. Emotionally.
Yeah, well, sense of well-being.
Right. Well, I think the connection there is that the digestive system, if you have a leaky gut, then particles and toxins can kind of go through the digestive system, through those holes into the bloodstream, and travel up into the brain and cross that blood-brain barrier that's supposed to protect them. And so because of that, there can be a lot of connection between your emotional issues or anxiety or depression and that leaky gut. So it's all very connected. So, yeah, a lot of people feel emotionally a lot calmer and less anxious.
Yep.
And exactly, less of the brain fog just with changing these things around.
And
so,
not to mention the gut is a brain, and so there's more serotonin receptors in the gut than there are in the brain. So in a way, it kind of operates on its own if everything's going right. You know, if the digestive system is working fine, then you don't, as soon as you put that sandwich in your mouth and you chew it, you forget about it.
Right.
That's the way it should happen. The gut should work on its own. You shouldn't have to be thinking about what's happening. But unfortunately, so many people are not eating well. And so the gut's basically screaming, hello, pay attention to me. You're not doing, you're not giving me what I want. And
mm-hmm.
and so so they're constantly, all they're aware of is that discomfort. And if you're walking around with with gas or bloating or acid reflux or constipation, you know, of course you're not going to be operating
right.
at your optimal level.
And that's the body telling you something.
Yeah,
you know?
And how about the intelligence of the human body, the resilience? I'm always shocked. I'm always amazed at how quickly things actually turn around, that people really, just given the right nutrition and nourishment, The little bit goes such a long way. It's astonishing.
Mm-hmm.
It really is.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned the four pillars of nutrition. What are the four pillars?
Okay. So the four pillars of nutrition, this comes from Kate Shanahan's book called Deep Nutrition. And basically, these four pillars are essentially what most traditional cultures have in common. So the first one is meat on the bone. So there is a reason why we all can't wait to eat our Thanksgiving turkey. Okay, it's all there together. We have meat on the bone, cooked in the juices, and you know that is one of the meals that all of us look most forward to every year. So that kind of represents meat on the bone to me.
Can I interrupt in there? Just what you just said about we all look forward to our Thanksgiving dinner. I think that's another thing that you know we'll call it pillar 1.5 is that people don't eat meals together anymore. So if you think about like when there's two nervous system states, right? There's fight or flight versus rest and digest. And when you're in the relaxed rest and digest state is when you get more out of your food. So that's part of coming together with a group of people, then sharing a meal, preparing a meal together. All that kind of gets missed in our culture when we're just on the go and eating fast. So I just want to interject that.
Exactly. It is so true. Yes, our state of mind when we are eating is very important in terms of how we digest that food. So, yeah. So the second pillar would be those organ meats that I already talked about. So I won't go too much further into that. And then the third pillar are fermented foods. So we didn't used to have refrigerators. So people had to find a way to store their foods. And how they did it was through fermented foods. Well, there was also a whole spectrum of health benefits that went along with that. So when we got refrigerators and we were introduced to industrial foods, we sort of dropped those. So fermented foods would be the third really important pillar. The fourth pillar is like raw or lightly cooked, and basically it means how you cook your vegetables and how you cook your meats. So, you know, if you trust your meat sources, then you don't have to overcook them. And also with the whole raw aspect, I'd like to talk a little bit about the raw dairy and all of the health benefits of drinking raw dairy and how, you know, most of us go to the store and we drink pasteurized milk and how that kills a lot of the proteins and the enzymes and the things that make us digestible. So, you know, people that are lactose intolerant, for instance, can handle the raw milk. Now, I will say that you really need to know your farmer. You need to know what the animal's eating in order to trust your source.
Yeah, that's what I always say. Know what the cow's eating or know what the goat's eating before you eat anything that comes from them. That's a smart way to do it.
Right, yeah. Right. So that would be the fourth pillar. Mm-hmm. It's just that raw or lightly cooked.
Awesome. Well, we are just about out of time. We want to thank Aubrey for coming this evening and spending a lot of time with us. And I think we've got enough information here. We could probably have you back three or four times and go into depth in any one of these topics. And if anybody wants to know more, I'm going to be posting a list of Aubrey's bibliography where some of this information has come from on our Facebook page at Bridge to Everywhere. And we also want to let you guys know what's coming up next. So we're going to be doing, this show will be rebroadcast Thursday evening at 2 p.m. And then in 2 weeks, we'll be having Joni Kirk. She's a naturopath. She'll be talking about natural approaches to allergies. Then 2 weeks after that, Stella Lynn will be talking about some topic in terms of herbs for health. Stella's a doula, and she's training to be a midwife. And then 2 weeks after that, we'll be having Leah Rostocki, and she'll be talking about Rolfing structural integration.
And in all of this, we want to be talking about health of the individual, but we also want to be looking at how that reflects in the health of the community. And then also look at the culture in which we live, which are our shared agreements about what really matters, what's really valuable. And all of these things really are interrelated. They're not separate. And so as we look at this, we really want to look at what do we care most about and what's most important. As we're talking about changing diet, wow, this is a big deal. And we'd only do it if we cared, and we'd only care if we valued what the result would be. So, you know, that's the adventure that we're on, is to discover what are the resources that we have in this community, what are the ways that we can make our community stronger, healthier, vital people coming together to live an inspired life and make a real difference.
So we'd like to thank everyone for joining us this evening on Bridge to Everywhere on Big Fermented Cabbage Radio, KVRF in Palmer.
Broadcasting on 89.5 on the FM dial.
Thank you. And thanks again, Aubrey, for coming.
Thanks for having me. It was really fun.
Look forward to having you on the show again.
Good.